Welcome to Feed Your Dog Facts, the internet's number one resource for fighting pet food industry misinformation and promoting evidence-based pet care. Now, here are your hosts, Daniel Shuloff and Alexis Malone.
Hello and happy 2024. We are back for the new year. This is our first episode after 2023, which if you guys tuned in to our show last year, you'll have seen that our number one episode was our label review on Ollie Nom Nom and the Farmer's Dog. So if you haven't checked that out yet, highly, highly recommend as our number one episode in 2023. Back for 2024, my name is Alexis Malone. I am your host alongside Dan Shuloff. He is here. He is the CEO of Keto Natural Pet Foods and author of Dogs, Dog Food, and Dogma. Dan, so good to see you in the new year. This episode, yes, we're talking about Wasava and the Wasava guidelines.
Yeah, that's right. It's a topic that we haven't dealt with directly before. It's something that I hear about pretty regularly from our customers. The most common context that you hear about the Wasava guidelines, at least in my experience, is that someone has heard something from their vet, and that something includes a reference to the Wasava guidelines. You know, somewhere else, if these are sort of ringing a bell for any of our listeners, somewhere else you might have read about them is if you read canine nutrition writing, you'll see them referenced sometimes from time to time, typically in a professional, like veterinary facing context. The reason for that is because Wasava is the World Small Animal Veterinary Association. They're a body composed that purports to represent the interests of veterinarians all around the world. So there's like, you know, national and even state level veterinary associations in the US. The national one is the AVMA, the American Veterinary Medical Association. Wasava is like one level up from that. It's the World Small Animal Veterinary Association. So it's for vets that take care of companion animals, dogs and cats across the world. And they put together, among other things, they've put together this list of dietary guidelines. They created it a long time ago. We'll go into the details of how it was created later in the episode. But generally speaking, they have this list of criteria. And they claim that veterinarians ought to encourage their clients to feed diets that comply with the Wasava guidelines. So one of the contexts that we'll often hear about Wasava at Keto Natural is we'll get customer service tickets from somebody that said, like, I'm looking into switching my dog to your food. My vet told me to only feed a diet that meets the Wasava guidelines. Does your food? And that's, you know, we go into it from there. So the guidelines are designed to help you say yes or no about whether you ought to feed a specific food to your dog. And so we're going to use this episode to tell you all about them, what they mean, what they are, what the specific guidelines are, and what we think about them, all that.
And we say Wasava, but it's actually W-S-A-V-A. And yeah, as you mentioned, animal. So not to be confused, there's no A at the beginning. I made that mistake when I was first doing my research. So just
great acronym. Like there aren't a lot of words in just normal English language that go WS at the beginning, but Wasava does. So they pronounce it Wasava apparently.
Okay. So the guidelines, tell me a little bit more about those.
So we'll get into what the specific guidelines are. They were created, I think, 2003, but we'll have show notes where we link to the Wasava website and some specific pages on the Wasava website so that everyone can take a look for themselves. But it's an official document official to the organization. And the document was created by what they called the Global Nutrition Guidelines Task Force. So they had a group of veterinarians that they put together at Wasava, and their goal working together was to put together these guidelines. They compared experiences, used whatever sources they were going to use, and came up with this document that specifies how veterinarians ought to talk to their clients about nutrition in Wasava's view. there are a few notable things about how it's all built before going into like the details of what the specific guidelines are. So one is that it goes outside, it covers more ground than just things to look for in selecting a brand. There's topics like body composition analysis that are relevant to the question of nutrition, because nutrition impacts body composition. And we know that body composition has a major impact on the health of dogs and cats. So there's a section of the guidelines that's like evaluating your clients for their body composition. Is this an obese dog or not? Because if it is, that's an issue that you should be dealing with as a vet. But when it comes to discussing pet food, the element of the like task force's report that everybody talks about is the like the actual guidelines themselves, the guidelines for selecting a pet food or evaluating a pet food. And then there's something notable about those as well, which is that like they're actually not framed. Everybody calls when you talk to somebody about WSAVA, the WSAVA guidelines, like a guideline is kind of an affirmative recommendation. Whereas the way that these are actually embodied in the document is as questions for veterinarians to ask their clients about the foods that their clients feed to their pets. And so they're not actually requirements. Like this is a sort of technical thing, but it's a little relevant. They're actually phrased as questions, but they imply correct answers, correct and incorrect answers pretty strongly. And so it's fair to summarize them and call them, like summarize them as or call them requirements, because these are things where there's clearly a right and wrong answer to the question. And so to just phrase it as the like, the requirement is that it meets, like that you could say yes to this question is kind of like how most people talk about them. And it's how we've sort of reduced them to our own words here, because I think we've done that and we could probably do that. We go into what are the specific WSAVA guidelines for selecting or evaluating a pet food.
And just a quick side question. Do you know who funds WSAVA?
I was intending to get into that as we get into like at least my perspective, our perspective on the guidelines and what they mean and what's wrong with them. Because yeah, there is information available to the public about how WSAVA is run, including how it obtains financing, who pays the organization to do what it does. Let's get to that when we get to like our reactions to what the guidelines are. Let's just go through them first. And so everybody is on the same page.
That's how you'll keep the listeners till the end. The juicy content.
That's we're teasing it. We know. And you're going to find out.
Okay. So WSAVA guidelines. I'm going to put them up on the screen right now. If you are watching this, then you'll be able to see the slide. If you are tuning in, we'll go through them and explain them all so you can listen.
Sweet. So this is our language, not actually WSAVA's, because like I said, they're phrased as questions. And so we try to be as loyal to the language as possible while kind of reducing them to guidelines. So five main things, recognizing that there are other things that go outside this that have to, that are embodied in the like formal document that WSAVA adopted and promotes. But this is when it comes to selecting a pet food, these are the five main things that they highlight. Number one, the brand of pet food that you're looking at or that you're feeding should employ a board certified veterinary nutritionist on a full-time basis and then use that person to formulate all of their recipes, all their diets. Number two, the brand should validate its nutrition contents using AFCO feeding trials as opposed to other methods. So what that means is like when a brand of pet food that you're feeding says that its food contains this much protein and this much carbohydrate, it has to base that on something. They can't just guess. And there are, under the relevant regulations, there are a few ways that you can legally show that your nutritional information is accurate. What WSAVA says is that you ought to make sure that your brand validates its nutritional contents using what are called AFCO feeding trials. Now, that's one of the ways that you can validate what's actually in the food. There are others. The others include biochemical analysis. You can send the diet off to a lab where they will evaluate exactly what's in there. That's another way to, that's like what I think of as the gold standard for validating with nutritional contents is like have a lab, an independent lab, analyze it and certify that's what it is. But you can also do it, and this is the most common thing in the pet food industry, just using like a database. Like you can, there are software that are available that you can say, okay, my diet is 20% chicken, 6% kelp, 18% beef bones, enter. What is the nutritional content? And that database will draw on some standardized information about those ingredients and calculate what it thinks your nutritional content is. And for the relevant legal purposes, that's good enough. That's the second way that you can validate the nutritional content of your pet food. And then the third way is the one that Wasava likes, which is you can do a test. You can have a group of dogs in certain laboratory style conditions, feed them your diet for a long enough period of time. And if certain bad things don't happen, it doesn't matter whether how the rest of the nutritional content is specified. That's good enough for the relevant regulations. If you run a feeding trial like that and the dogs don't grow horns or what are the other negative things that they outline in the protocol, then you're good to go. And Wasava thinks that's what you should look for.
I'm actually going to pause you right there. So yeah. On Keto Naturals YouTube page, you actually have an entire episode that goes over those three different options. So if you're interested in learning more and kind of diving a little bit more into that topic, we do already have something up on our YouTube that you can reference. So now back to the Wasava guidelines, number three.
Good call. Yeah, exactly. There's more information on that and we'll like loop back to this, but yeah, totally good point. But anyway, the third of the five Wasava guidelines is that the product, or at least the brand that makes the product, should be featured in studies published in peer-reviewed journals, which is kind of a wishy-washy way of saying, like, if you go poke around the peer-reviewed literature well enough, you're going to find at least a study looking at some quality about the diet. There's no like such thing as a peer-reviewed study to say the diet is good. That's not a thing. Like, there's no just journal article that says, like, we looked at Bob's pet food and we gave it the A-OK. Therefore, it's like adopted by the peer review community. That's not a thing. But the closest thing that Wasava is sort of saying is, like, you want to look for brands that are in the peer reviewed literature that somebody's been studying in some kind of way. Number four is pretty straightforward. There should be a public phone number and email address so you can contact representatives of the brand to ask them these kinds of questions. And then number five, the brand that makes the food you're looking at should make its products in a factory that it owns, not one owned by a third party. And that's pretty straightforward too. And those are the five main guidelines that Wasava sets forth. So there are a few things that I think folks should note about those five guidelines. And maybe you could pull the slide back up so that I can like stay organized as I go through them. But the first is that, like, on a pure plausibility basis, only some of these feel like they would in any way encourage the selection of healthy pet food products. Like, for instance, the first requirement, if somebody has a board certified veterinary nutritionist on a full-time basis making their diets, that's probably a good thing. All else considered, it wouldn't surprise me if someone could develop evidence that brands that have full-time veterinary nutritionists on staff are making products that are healthier for dogs. That wouldn't surprise me. It seems like a plausible theory to me. But that's not the case for all of them. For instance, particularly the second requirement, the idea that the best brands use AFCO feeding trials to validate their nutritional content does not at all feel plausible to me. And as I kind of highlighted in the episode that, Lexi, that you mentioned earlier, that like talks about the three different ways of validating nutritional contents, the AFCO feeding trial methodology is not like the most, it's like the exception to validating nutritional contents. It's like the way that, well, whatever you say is actually in there, if you can show us that dogs aren't really bad, things are happening to them when you feed it to your food, feed it your food, then that's okay with us, says AFCO, the relevant regulators. So it is not like the most precise, accurate way of validating nutritional content. Quite to the contrary, it's the least accurate way. And so to me, that is not a plausible, it's not plausible to me that if you were to test, does the brand use feeding trials or not, that the ones that do are more likely to produce healthy outcomes in dogs. I think that's very unlikely if you were to test that. And the others, somewhere in between, right? It's like, if a brand has a phone number and an email address, like think about if you were to just take, I don't know, 100 brands of pet food and separate them out into companies that list a public phone number and email address and ones that don't, and then do a study where you fed some selection of those to dogs in two different groups. Do we really think the ones with the email addresses would be have healthier outcomes? I mean, I guess maybe, but it seems kind of like you're just about as likely to be like, well, the black bags that have the color blue on them are producing healthy. It feels pretty unrelated to me. It might, okay, I sort of can see a rationale, but it's a little attenuated to me. And same with who owns the facility, right? It's like, really? Like they're, you know, in the pet food industry, contract manufacturers do the by far the bulk of the production, just like in the human food industry. Like the consumer brands that come up with recipes, package the product, sell it to consumers, distribute it, are in the vast majority of cases not the ones who are doing the factory work to make the food. They engage folks who have gone through the effort of building hundreds of millions of dollars worth of factory equipment and specify to them, here's the kind of diet we want. We want these ingredients, this nutritional content, this size, this shape, this color. You work with them over a period of time to produce it. Do we really think that, like, if the brand owns the factory, that it's likely to produce healthier outcomes? Again, doesn't feel very plausible to me. It's a little, not that that's like the meat of this discussion, but I just want to give everyone a vibe that, like, these things kind of don't pass the smell test at baseline. To me, at least. Did I cut you off?
Pet food. Well, no, I got so excited because Pet Food Industry News just put out a article that was comparing whether, like, what shape and size of kibble dogs prefer. And it feels very like, I mean, there's obviously, you know, certain aspects that you have to be cautious of. Like, you know, you don't want your dog choking on a piece of kibble or, you know, what have you. But like the idea that we're choosing pet food because of the fact that they have a customer service phone number or because of the fact that the dogs liked the square shaped kibbles slightly more than the round shaped kibbles is just feels silly.
Yeah, exactly. But it's really common that phenomenon where it feels like we're whether or not some issue, some quality criteria is marginally better or marginally worse for dogs. Focusing in on that is a really common thing in this industry, and it's a really bad thing that needs to change. There is this, like, you know, when you think about the nutrition-related health problems that companion animals experience in the Western world, there are huge ones that kill tons of dogs every year. Obesity, cancer, diabetes. These are huge problems, epidemic problems that the community, the veterinary community, is having a real challenge solving that make people go through all kinds of pain and grief and hardship trying to figure them out. But instead of focusing research dollars and guidelines on the kinds of topics that help with that stuff, we get this stuff that's focused on this minutia that's so unrelated to the big, it's like, guys, there are bigger fish to fry than what size kibble a dog prefers to eat based on its given weight, what color kibble, whether your email address is on the, it's just like, it's so common that it feels deliberate. And it seems to me that it very likely is that part of what's going on here is we're trying to say, look over here at all these interesting things because we don't want you looking too hard at the stuff that really matters, because we don't like what the answers are there. That's what it seemed to me.
Yeah. I mean, when we were running through the guidelines, you know, the thing that kept popping into my mind was like, it just seems like you have to have a lot of money to be able to do a lot of this.
Yeah. So I will submit to you that I think that is precisely what these guidelines are intended to do. So when I read these, and this is not something you will find in the formal report that the WSSAVA task force put together, I would say, of course, you won't find it there. But one thing that I think is pretty tough to deny, you got to be pretty gullible if you think that these guidelines aren't designed to encourage people to feed products from certain kinds of companies, mainly the largest ones. So if you pull them back up, let's walk through the specific guidelines and why they do that. So let's just ignore the phone number, email address thing for a minute. Like that, I don't even know what to say about that one, honestly. But the other four, like, you can't do this stuff to any serious degree until you've got a ton of money. If you want to be a disruptor, somebody that's like, the industry has problems, I'm going to start my own company to fix those problems and do things better. You cannot meet these guidelines, period. Okay. And the reasons for that are that these are things that require more money than you have at that stage. You're only going to have enough money to do these things once you get massive. Now, the most glaring example of that is owning your own facility as opposed to using a third-party facility to produce your food. You have to have hundreds of millions of dollars to build something like that. And the idea that you should only feed a dog food that is doing that is a way of self-selecting for only the largest brands, okay? You have to be around for a very long time and have tons and tons and tons of customers before you're generating enough money to build your own factory. That's just a thing. Secondly, similar thing can be said about requirements 1, 2, and 3. Having a board certified veterinary nutritionist on a full-time basis on your faculty, on your payroll is, on the one hand, is like, well, that's not that expensive. It's one person's salary, and that's fair. But there is a problem, which is that that is a tiny community. There are only about 100 board certified veterinary nutritionists in all of the United States, and at least a third or 40% work for one company, okay? And there are hundreds of pet food brands. There just aren't, if you want somebody, and you can only work full-time for one company at a time, there's not enough to go around, okay? That's just, you are going to exclude people from that group. No matter how bad somebody wants to put a veterinary nutritionist on staff, there are only so many of them. You can't get them full-time. Plenty of them work in academia. That's their full-time job. So if you want to meet this, you've got to have established a relationship with this kind of person over a period of years, got them onto your payroll, got to be big enough to pay them, et cetera. Hard to do, self-selecting for just the biggest, oldest brands. AFCO feeding trial, similar. As I highlighted before, that's not a particularly good way to validate the nutritional content of a specific recipe, but what it is more expensive than the other methodologies for evaluating nutritional contents, because you got to pay to do a study involving several, I don't know exactly off the top of my head what the number of animals is, but you're talking about like a dozen at least dogs, where you're just going to keep them at your facility for a period of time, feed them your diet, have experts analyze them, keep them in specific conditions and evaluate whether specific things happen to the animals. That is much more expensive, but much less helpful than just sending the diet off to a biochemical analytics firm so they can tell you exactly what the nutritional contents is. Okay. So again, it's a way of saying that you got to be a wealthy company and it's been around for a while to meet this. And then the same thing you could say about studies published in peer-reviewed journals. Like, scientists don't just go around pulling random questions about a product out of the blue and try to solve it. It's like they look for stuff that is most relevant to the community that people want to know about. They're not running studies about fringe new upstart products. That's like a hard thing to try to encourage folks to do. Whereas if you are a huge multinational company, you know, you're publicly traded, you've been selling food in the United States for 40 years, you have 30 veterinary nutritionists on staff anyway, you're producing that kind of literature about your products on your own. So again, it's a way of being like, the brands that meet these standards are the largest brands. And it, in reality, in fact, it comes down to three brands. They're really, when you see folks discuss Wasava, and I'm not, let me make clear like what I mean when I say that. I don't know if there are other brands that actually do comply, in their eyes at least, with Wasava. Because Wasava doesn't like publish, say, like, we're evaluating every brand in the US, here are the ones that comply and here's the ones that don't. Is there knowledge available that we can independently say, yeah, this brand's big enough, or this brand satisfies the requirements? There might be others that do, but most commonly, when you hear purported experts talk about the Wasava guidelines, what they will say is there are really only three brands that satisfy this: Purina, Royal Canin, owned by Mars, and Hill's Pet Nutrition, owned by Colgate-Palmolive. That's it. Those are the only three. And that would kind of be what you would expect, right? When you read these and you go, what do these really do? They self-select for the largest brands. Those are the three largest brands in the country. It's not rocket science.
Now, are they funded by the largest? So
let's get to what's wrong with the guidelines. So those are the guidelines. Those are some initial thoughts about what they do, how they work, if they're plausible or not. But we've got some much more specific criticisms of the guidelines. Maybe you can pull up that slide so that folks that are watching can take a look at it. Okay. Four things that I think are very wrong with the Wasava guidelines. Number one, they're not evidence-based. There is not one single piece of evidence that says any of the Wasava guidelines is likely to make a dog healthier. Okay. If that doesn't sound like a well duh to you, I'd also highlight for you that like there are human nutritional organizations by the barrelful that publish their own guidelines. So the FDA and the USDA are like examples of organizations that try to tell people what they ought to eat for their health, just like Wasava is purporting to do the same thing when it's telling you what to feed your dog for its health. But when the USDA puts together its dietary guidelines, they're based on huge bodies of evidence that say eating this does this to your health, eating that does this to your health. There's studies that show that these things are better or worse, and real professionals can debate them. That's not the case with Wasava. There's no study that says, like we highlighted before, which ones feel plausible and which ones aren't plausible, but there's not one study that says if you make your dog food in a factory that you own, the dogs live 2 years longer on average than third-party factories. That's not a thing. It's not a thing about veterinary nutritionists. It's not a thing about AFCO feeding trials. So whether or not they feel plausible, there's no evidence basis. So these guidelines were written by scientists, people who are supposed to, just like the folks who represent the USDA, supposed to respect, understand, know about the scientific record pertaining to the topics they're writing about. That's why they're considered experts. But that stuff has nothing to do with these specific guidelines. And that's a huge problem. You shouldn't think of these as authoritative, meaningful, helpful guidelines because they have no evidence supporting them. Problem number one. Problem number two, just as bad. They have failed. Okay. The Wasava guidelines have been in place for something like 20 years. During that 20-year period of time, dogs and cats in America have not gotten healthier. They have gotten less healthy. Problems like obesity, cancer, diabetes, and other chronic non-communicable diseases have not gotten better. Okay. Whatever Wasava has done as the most authoritative global veterinary body, they haven't produced good outcomes. And no matter who you are, if you spend 20 years trying something one way and you get bad results, you got to look at yourself in the mirror and say, maybe we're doing something wrong here. Maybe we should like try to do this a little bit more like the USDA does it, WHO, World Health Organization. What, maybe we should do it more like how they do it and try to put together recommendations based on evidence. Like, it's not an altogether ridiculous concept, but it's a separate reason why something that's wrong with the guidelines. They failed, okay? They haven't helped make anything better since they've been published. Third is the one that we've highlighted a few times already, which is that the very same companies that they promote are the ones that created them. And this is sort of the root of all the other criticisms. Wasava has three industry financial partners, and you can find, this is publicly available information. This is not me speculating. You can find this on the Wasava website. We will put a link in the show notes to the Wasava industry partners page. Three pet food companies listed on there. I'll give you a guess what three they are. They are the very same three that the guidelines lead you to choose. Purina, Hill's Pet Nutrition, and Royal Canin, which is Mars Pet Care.
I knew it.
It's not, that's like, you have to be, if you think that that's a coincidence, I have a bridge to sell you. Like that is, you have to be ridiculous to think that that's just a nifty coincidence. And when you combined it with the fact that they're not evidence-based guidelines and that they've failed, I don't see how anybody can look at these guidelines and say anything other than these need to be thrown out. These should be disregarded and replaced with something better. Yeah. So let me highlight a few other things on this topic. The first is that the actual vets who made up the task force that ended up composing the Wasava guidelines, also just happened to be led by who is, in my judgment, the biggest pet food industry shill of the past century. This is a Tufts professor whose name is Lisa Freeman. She was the first name on the task force report for Wasava. And if you look up Lisa Freeman's body of work, what you'll find are a few things in common among the studies that she has put out. Number one, they all contain voluminous conflicts of interest disclosures concerning the very same companies that pay for Wasava's work. So not only are Hill's and Purina paying Wasava, Hill's and Purina are paying Lisa Freeman directly. Okay. She is somebody who for decades has always, on every paper that she puts out, has to disclose, I do paid work for these two companies. I'm not sure about Royal Canin, but I am certain about the other two. Secondly, you can find her, the other thing that Lisa Freeman's work tends to do is it all tends to reach the same conclusion. And it's the same conclusion reached by the Wasava guidelines. No matter what topic Lisa Freeman is writing about, the recommendation that she arrives at after writing about it just happens to be you should choose something from either Purina, Hill's, or Mars Petcare. And the same kind of advice, the same kind of conclusion has emerged. I'll highlight this by highlighting two other things that she's spent a chunk of her professional life researching. First is raw diets. Are raw diets good or bad for dogs? There was a period between 10 and 20 years ago where Lisa Freeman seemed to be dedicating her life to putting out research on this subject, studying raw diets and figuring out, is there anything good or anything bad associated with these? And lo and behold, she determined that there's a lot that's really bad. There's a perspective that's common in the veterinary community these days. If you go into a veterinary office, I'll take your money if you want to make a bet on this. You ask your vet, what do you think about raw diets? I will bet you, anyone listening to this show, send me an email, that your vet will say two things. There's no evidence that raw diets do anything good for your dog, but there is evidence that they can give you, that you can get foodborne pathogens that will make you and your dog sick. Therefore, I recommend that you avoid them. That perspective was developed through research put out by Lisa Freeman. She was the main moving force behind that body of research. And it just happens to recommend the very same thing that the Wasava guidelines writ large recommend, which is just avoid that stuff altogether and feed Purina, Hill's, Mars. And then the other example, the third, like Lisa Freeman body of work that just happens to come to this same conclusion is DCM. Lisa Freeman is the dominant, the moving force that motivated the DCM scandal. She is the one who wrote to the FDA and told them you should look into this. She is the one that put out the most papers on the subject of DCM, the most popular papers, gave talks about it. Just like with raw diets, Lisa Freeman was the veterinarian who made the DCM scandal most, made it a thing. And lo and behold, what has emerged from the DCM scandal? Well, according to Lisa Freeman, you should be worried about DCM. And in order to placate, to manage those worries, you should feed your dog something that's a non-BEG diet, which is a technical term that she came up with that in practice means Hill's, Purina, Mars Petcare, same three companies. And like I said, they just happen to be the same three companies that pay for the WSAVA guidelines to be made. Long-winded way of saying none of which would be a valid argument for saying the evidence showing that these work should be ignored. You know what I mean? Like if there were 10 studies that had been lined up that were like, when people follow the WSAVA guidelines, their dogs tend to live 12 years longer. You could highlight all this stuff and it might be suggestive of bias, but at the end of the day, you've still got that body of evidence that's proof that this is doing something good and you can talk about the evidence. But in this case, there is no evidence. There is none. It's just like, trust me, I think this and I'm legit, trust me. And I'm pointing it out because that's the particular kind of case where those biases, those conflict of interest have the greatest potential to mislead. And so, yeah, they're present here. And in my judgment, I would, you know, bet dollars to donuts that that's where they came from in the first instance, that they put true promotion of evidence-based medicine behind industrial interests.
I like briefly cut to us after you even mentioned the first point of what's wrong with the WSAVA guidelines, because I'm just sitting here like, why is pet food, why is this industry ignoring so much science? It just feels like there is so much that is ignored for the benefit of these larger companies.
Yeah, I mean, the short answer, there is a short answer to that question, in my judgment, which is that there's less funding available in this field of science than there is in most legitimate fields of science. What funding there is available to carry out the scientific work that needs to take place to educate the veterinary community about what really changes dogs' health is almost exclusively from industry. If you're studying issues pertaining to human health, you can get funding from more other places than just going to companies and asking for it. Pet food, it's fewer people, fewer studies being done, smaller pool of money, and it's just industry or essentially nothing. And because of that, industry gets to influence every step of the process. And because industry is at the heart of what the problems are, you just have this Kafka-esque backwards bought out world. And it's gross and it's a problem. But I think that ultimately, if you wanted like a lightning bolt, single silver bullet fix, it would be that there's a pool of money guarded by disinterested, conflicts-free parties that distribute to any veterinary nutrition researcher that's interested in answering a question or promoting some theory, idea, new evidence, whatever. If you had that, over time, that would come to take over the industry-funded side of it, which is what you see when you, like, these days, when you go around and talk to folks about what the veterinary nutritional science, the latest, what it says.
Yeah, it's like if all the pet owners could rally. And
well, that's the idea behind the nonprofit. That's the Pet Food Consumer Rights Council. That's the idea, is we're going to pool small donations from each individual pet owner and use it to create a single fund that can be disseminated for this purpose. But as I long suspected and as I've learned, there's a hard message to get out there when you're competing against multi-billion dollar multinational companies and getting people behind that, understanding the scope of the problem, why that's a good solution, et cetera, is hard and takes forever. And it's not, unfortunately, for plenty of pet owners and individual companion animals that are walking the earth right now, it is going to take longer than their lifetime for it to meaningfully change. And so
yes.
If anybody else has any better ideas, I'm all ears. You know how to reach us because we're committed to it, but it's not easy.
And I just want to make sure here that we touch on the last point of...
Fourth thing that's wrong with the guidelines. So what we've already highlighted, to recap, not evidence-based, okay? There's nothing that actually says these work. Number two, they failed. There's actually evidence that they work poorly because dogs and cats have gotten worse over the past time, over the time they've been a thing. Number three, they are clearly promoting the interests of the small number of companies that fund them, as opposed to the interests of everybody else. And then number four is that they're really different from the guidelines that the USDA or the World Health Organization or anybody else puts out on nutritional topics, in that they're not substantive. They're not actually about nutrition. They're about business. It's like, you don't see the word protein in there. You don't see the words micronutrients in there. This is not how the USDA's guidelines work. They work through food groups where they talk about you should eat this many servings of this type of food each day. But they do that in order to generalize about nutritional subjects. They know that generally speaking, meats contain this much protein. And so we recommend this many servings of meat a day because we're trying to do is recommend this much protein or this much amino acids, that kind of thing. And they're built in that kind of way where you start with substantive recommendations. Make sure you take this much of this, as little of this as you can, as much of this as you can, because all those things the science says are bad for health. And then let's shape that into guidelines. That's not WSABA. WSABA not only doesn't have evidence that says they work, in any of the individual ones work, but they're not even about nutrition in the same kind of way that the USDA's nutrition guidance is based on that kind of stuff. And so, again, I think that that's a clear way that if WSABA was serious about using its guidelines to make companion animals healthier, that's a clear thing they could do, is they could say, we're going to charge our task force with compiling evidence-based substantive guidelines for what people ought to feed their pets, as opposed to things that are focused on what kind of brand, how big the brand is, how that kind of stuff is just it'd be ridiculous if the WHO did something like that, right? If they were make sure you only eat products that are produced by, companies that use red boxes or something like that, which is what this boils down to. So yeah, that's a fourth major criticism of them.
Okay, so I'm a pet food consumer. I have been persuaded by all of these flashy terms at first. So I really like AFCO feeding trials and board certified veterinary nutritionist. And I feel really good until I listen to this episode and I am like, wow, this is something that needs to change. This is actually not what I was originally persuaded by at all. How, as a pet food consumer, can I make an impact or potentially reach out to WSABA and demand that this becomes something different?
Well, I'm sure you can communicate with WSABA directly, but I wouldn't personally feel all that confident that that type of thing is likely to go anywhere. Maybe I'm a cynic, but I would say that money speaks louder than individual consumer complaints. As wonderful as our podcast is, this is not 60 minutes, okay? Our audience is small, probably not going to make a huge impact there. But the first step is understanding. And so maybe you came into this episode because you've heard of the WSABA guidelines. Maybe you heard it from your vet. Maybe your vet recommended the same things that WSABA recommends. You should feed a dog food that meets the WSABA guidelines. Hopefully this episode, my perspective is that you ought to ignore them. You ought to do a few things. Number one, you ought to ignore any recommendation that you should feed dog food that meets the WSABA guidelines. Full stop, period. I think that's the case. I think if I had to bet, and there's no evidence on this, I think your animal is less likely to be healthy if you just select for brands that meet the WSABA guidelines, because the nutritional contents of which those brands make up their food are poor. They're too heavy in easily digestible carbohydrate, which the studies show is bad for dogs, period. And so I think it's likely that if you follow the WSABA guidelines, you're going to be doing bad things for your animal's health. But that's just my belief. But again, what I think is you ought to ignore it is first and foremost for the reasons we've highlighted here. Second, I think you ought to advocate that they be changed for the reasons that we're highlighting here. And that looks like if you feel like this is persuasive, Next time you hear Wasava come up, you should tell people about this episode. There will be an accompanying like sister written article that we'll put out that you can disseminate in that kind of way as well. But it's like when your vet tells you, yeah, Wasava is the real way to think about this. That's the gold standard for pet food. Tell them, I listened to this. It was pretty persuasive to me. Why don't you give it a listen and then get back to, let's talk the next time I'm in about what they say. Maybe I'm wrong about all this stuff. And this is your veterinarian is going to explain to you why I'm wrong. I think more likely if they listen to this, they're going to say, I didn't really know that. And that does cause me to think about Wasava in a somewhat different way. Because I believe that all the information we're giving you in this episode is factually accurate. And I believe that if the veterinary community as a whole knew all that information, the Wasava guidelines would not be well followed, would not be popular, would not be respected by the veterinary community. So what that means is that, like, if you think that it's wrong that these things are doing this, that are functioning in this way or this socially significant, play a role in advocating for them to be disregarded, to highlight they're not evidence-based, they're not substantive, they haven't worked, they're clearly influenced by industry. Those are things that matter to anyone that's like a fair-minded and benevolent, like somebody that's really working for positive change. It should have a role. You know, as to how they ought to be replaced, this is a bigger project. There's one probably, unless you're a professional in this domain, might be outside the scope of your bandwidth, because it's just like you're talking about making changes to how an industry functions, which I can tell you is really hard. But things like getting the US FDA to publish its own substantive evidence-based guidelines for what's healthy for dogs and cats, that would be a great thing. Like right now, if you want substantive information about what is or isn't healthy, what kind of nutritional profile is or isn't healthy for a dog and cat, the closest kind of stuff you get is like AFCO's complete and balanced requirements. Like if you sell a pet food in the US, it must contain certain nutritional qualities. It has to contain this much protein, because the evidence says, if you eat less than this much protein, you're going to get a deficiency disease in your dog. So in order to sell this stuff, any pet food as complete and balanced, it's got to meet this profile. AFCO should also, and the US FDA should also, put out like guidelines for optimal health. Not just like, if you give it this, you won't give it a deficiency disease. Like, that's good. We do need that. But there should be something more, which is like, if you can, what's really been shown to be best for the animal's health is this. In the same way that like, none of us eat according to the FDA's or the USDA's dietary guidelines for Americans. Like, it's hard to, there's plenty of reasons why people don't always just use the guidelines. Some of them are that people disagree with them for valid reasons. You know, there are people that consider the evidence and think that the USDA got it wrong, or that they've been influenced by, you know, forces other than promoting optimal health. But at least we're having a discussion about what's optimal. This is not that. The terms of there's no way to talk about the evidence because there is no evidence on these things. So those things would be a better pet food world. But frankly, sadly, they're probably a ways down the road, probably not happening in the year of our Lord 2024. But
maybe not this year, but we can keep hoping.
Actionable stuff for people to do. Just try to get engagement. Try to get your vet to listen and tell you why they think this is wrong. Do that. That will be helpful for you and your understanding. Because there might be 10 things that I've said here today that are just dead wrong, and your vet might explain them to you. And then, you know, good on them. I doubt
it. Yes, and then to us. Send it to us.
We'll address it.
Excellent. Well, this has been such a fun episode, as always. I learned so much. I came into this with, again, just kind of these, I've been into my vet's office and I have heard about the Wasava guidelines, and I've seen some of these really catchy terms, and it looks good to someone who just is tuning in for 30 seconds. And that's kind of all
that's a big part of it. Yeah. I think you hit the nail on the head before that. Like, part of what has made them successful in getting traction is like, they have the buzzwords, you know what I mean? It's like board certified veterinary nutritionist, ooh, peer reviewed studies, ooh, like AFCO feeding trial, like that all feels very legit. You know what I mean? And you have to not dig super deep, but you have to pull back. You have to not just take it at face value that like, sounds good, is good. And once you do just a little bit of lifting there, it feels really different. But they do a nice job of getting the buzzwords in.
Our title for this episode is What's Wrong with Wasava? So hopefully that has enough W's for you in there that it is catchy for general audience. But thank you guys so much for tuning in. If you have any follow-up questions, feel free to reach out to us at Feed Your Dog Facts. We will link all of the relevant sources, and also I'll put up that YouTube episode that we referenced about the AFCO feeding trials in the show notes. Anything else to add, Dan, before we say goodbye for now?
No, plenty. We love feedback. Give us feedback and we'll be happy to address it on air or otherwise.
Excellent. Well, thank you for listening. Thank you for watching. And we will see you guys soon.